lift your head, weary be sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waiting there.
This is Andrew Wood, and I'm the Executive Director of Hope Resource Center, and I'm currently in Washington, D.C., and I've been here for a couple days now and going to be here for a few more days because of the big winter storm that's hitting. As it's snowing outside right now, and they're expecting around, 25 to 30 inches. So I have a lot of time to think and a lot of time to write and also to post. And so that's what I'm going to be doing. This is going to be a special podcast edition for Hope Resource Center. But while I've been up here, I attended Evangelicals for Life, which was a conference put on by the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and just an amazing opportunity to come together with believers to stand for life. So just today, we had an opportunity to march and march with thousands of people. So even though the snow was coming, and we knew it was coming, and we knew it was going to be bitterly cold, thousands of people still showed up to stand and march for life. But also while I've been up here, I had an opportunity to sit down with two leaders in the Christian movement, two evangelical leaders, and one of those being John Stonestreet, who is the president of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and an amazing guy. Wrote a few books, and he's just a great thinker and an amazing guy to sit down with. So I had an opportunity to sit down with him, and also had an opportunity to sit down with Dr. Russell Moore, who is the president of the ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, as a partner and part of the Southern Baptist Convention. So loved sitting down with them. They are somewhat heroes for me with the work that they do, the writing that they participate in. So certainly thankful to sit down with them. And so that's what this podcast is. It's about a 10-minute interview with Dr. Moore, and then about a 15-minute interview with John Stonestreet. As you get to hear their heart for life, and you get to hear what they're doing and what we need to do as Christians, what we need to do as pro-life clinics around the country to stand and be bold for life. And so I hope you enjoy it. I hope you get something out of it. And I hope that it glorifies God in all that we do. And that's ultimately what we're here for, is to celebrate God and then to celebrate those that have been made in His image, which is every single human being. And along with that, kind of the theme for me this week has been, the goal is not to make abortion illegal. The goal is to make abortion unthinkable in a civilized society. That is the goal. That's what we want to do, and that's what we want to see happen. That's why we open our doors at Hope Resource Center every single day, is to love and serve and take care of women and men in crisis, and then, of course, see babies saved in that process as well. Hope you enjoy the interviews. Hope you enjoy the conversation, and there'll be more to come in the next few weeks as well, as we continue to touch on this and continue to talk about standing for life in a culture of death. Thank you for listening.
You're a good, good father. It's who you are. It's who you are. It's who you are. And I'm loved by you.
I guess my first question, I first want to thank you for doing this weekend. I know the weather is kind of terrible, but or at least we think it's going to be terrible. But as president of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview, what do you see as the biggest issue we face with impacting and transforming the culture of death we seem to have in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, it's the culture. I mean, that's what it is. I think sometimes we look at issues of abortion or euthanasia, beginning or end of life issues, and we see lives in danger, and we take it as kind of a one-off issue. And this goes all the way back to what Francis Schaeffer said, is that we tend to see the world in bits and pieces instead of totals. Mm-hmm. I'm really encouraged, for example, as are many others, with the polling of millennials, and how, even walking around here at the March for Life, you see all these millennials there, which is phenomenal. The numbers tell us that millennials are more pro-life than their parents. But millennials are also more relativistic than their parents.
Right.
So some polling shows us that, this is a generation that's more pro-life in their personal views, but also more likely to drive their friend to an abortion clinic. And so that's a cultural issue, the culture of relativism. I think the culture in which stuff is more important than people, a culture in which we'd rather look at little glowing rectangles than mm-hmm. in people's eyes. I mean, these are cultural issues that debase and devalue life. And then we see this really played out, you know, I think particularly with the community of those with disability, right? I mean, so now we've targeted Down syndrome children for abortions in the womb. We're getting better at looking into the womb, and we have this technology to, quote-unquote, get rid of the problem. So mm-hmm. the more conditions we come up with, the more conditions are going to be targeted. Look, unless we can get upstream on some of these issues to those fundamental worldview beliefs, what we think is true, what we think gives human dignity and human value, that's going to be, in the long term, the most important aspect, I think, of this whole conversation.
Yeah, and I think that I loved what you said last night when you said the goal is not to simply make it illegal. The goal is to make it unthinkable,
right,
in a civilized society. Mm-hmm. And I mean, goodness gracious, the amount of abortions that are occurring, and then for so many to not even it doesn't even bother them. It's not even on their radar. But that brings me to my next question. In 2015. The country was rocked with the videos on Planned Parenthood, and we saw, I remember seeing the first video and just weeping at my desk as I watched the callousness of the abortion industry. What do you think those videos being released, what are we going to see in our society now that those have been released and we've heard about the harvesting and selling of aborted baby parts? Do you think that is going to make a difference? Not, and some people talked yesterday that certainly is making a difference with hearings and stuff in D.C. Mm-hmm. But what about the culture? Mm-hmm. Is it making a difference in people in just everyday America?
Well, I think it's done culturally a couple things. I think one is that it's created additional momentum for the pro-life movement. So, you know, albeit everything that I just said about getting to these fundamental cultural issues, there's tons of momentum on this issue. If you look at almost any other cultural issue that Christians care about, it tends to be headed in the wrong direction. This one doesn't. And I think the videos were part of that. I think for a whole lot of people, the facade of Planned Parenthood cracked. It mm-hmm. created context for all kinds of conversations. I mean, the number of people who still think, for example, that Planned Parenthood does mammograms, even that, you know, was undermined. The number of people who didn't think Planned Parenthood, you know, that they were primarily about women's health and, you know, only 3% of their services. I mean, that number still gets thrown around, but people were able to challenge that number and so on. And then just the grave evil, you know. I mean, we have to remember, too, that this is the Planned Parenthood videos after the Kermit Gosnell.
Right.
And I still think the Kermit Gosnell thing is going to, you know, if you remember in the civil rights movement, there was, you know, Rosa Parks' courageous mm-hmm. decision, but that came after the Emmett Till revelation of the lynching of the Chicago teenager. You know, it takes a couple things to create this sort of momentum. And so and listen, it's, even if it did create hearings in D.C., it's certainly creating some investigations. The 2016 election will determine how far those investigations go. And a hearing in D.C., we might roll our eyes at it, but it's going to be some hearing at some point that's going to eventually lead to defunding. So that's not altogether a bad thing. We just can't put all the eggs in the political basket.
Right. So you have said that abortion is the greatest evil of our day. In light of this evil, what would your call to action be for church leaders?
Yeah, well, I think the Christians are called in any culture to confront evil. In my book, Restoring All Things, Warren Cole Smith, my co-author, and I say that Christians are to do really four things. We're to promote the good, we're to stop the evil, we're to contribute what's missing, and we're to restore the broken. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you look at those four things, Christians have always done remarkable things when they've stood up and said no. I mean, many people know the wonderful story of the monk, Demelicus, who jumped into the middle of the arena in the gladiator fights and said, you know, no, and they killed him, but it stopped the gladiator fights. It takes some of that heroic action. So I think it is a responsibility for us to make that a priority, even the priority. I would say, too, that whenever there's evil, there are victims. We often say ideas have consequences, which is true. Bad ideas have bad consequences. But ideas have victims. People pay the price for bad ideas. The victims of abortion aren't just, that there's, half the American public on the wrong side of history or something mm-hmm. like that. I mean, A, there's real lives being lost. B, there's real women being lied to. C, there's real men who are being sold a bill of goods from the sexual revolution that they can have what they want without consequences. Or they're being left out of the decision altogether, when it comes to abortion. There's grandparents without grandchildren, mm-hmm. There's siblings without a sibling. There's abortion industry workers who just think they're doing the right thing and are deceived by bad ideas. The church always thrives, and the church has always helped stop evil quicker when it does really good victim care. Mm-hmm. Not just triage. We do some good triage, I think, in the pro-life movement, and I think the overall care, has to be there. So I think that's a responsibility. And the other thing is, there's a saying that we often attribute to St. Francis of Assisi, preach the gospel at all times, mm-hmm. when necessary, use words. The problem is with that quote is that, from everything I can tell, St. Francis probably didn't say it. But even if he did, the gospel is a message. Mm-hmm. It's not just that it is a lifestyle, but it is a message. It is a message about who we are, whose we are, and the story of the world. And so we've actually got to speak up. Chuck Colson used to talk about the importance of over the backyard fence and around the barbecue grill, mm-hmm. The importance of grassroots and everyday Christians, for example, there's the myth, and it continues to get thrown around, and it sounds more and more ridiculous because of the excellent work of the pregnancy care centers. But the myth is something like, pro-lifers only care about children until they're born, right? The more families are lining up to adopt, the more pregnancy care center workers are, it's changing that myth. And, mm-hmm. If whenever that got thrown around the media, people thought, oh yeah, those Christians are bums, except for that one, and they had a story in their mind of that Christian who walked that lady, or that Christian who walked maybe them personally through some sort of situation. That's what changes the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the victim care we want to have.
And that's a good transition. As executive director of a medical clinic, pro-life clinic in Knoxville, you oftentimes say your heroes are those that are working in the pregnancy center. So how can we educate and inform our culture of the great work so many pro-life clinics are doing in this country?
Yeah. Well, I think, the rest of us have a responsibility to champion it. I mean, I think if everyday people in the pews who cared about this cause realized, the budgets you guys work on versus the millions of dollars of taxpayer funding that goes to Planned Parenthood, they would be a little bit frustrated.
I saw a stat the other day. There's between 2,500 and 3,000 pro-life clinics around the country, roughly, pregnancy centers. If you combine their budgets, it's $400 million. And the government gives Planned Parenthood $500 million every single year. So that just puts it into perspective.
And some people don't know how big some of these clinics, how big some of these pregnancy care centers are. I mean, mm-hmm. I was up in Chicago and the work, six clinics and a whole mm-hmm. network. I mean, you guys do the work, of execs of companies, and my guess is you're not exactly getting, an equal pay there. But that's not the point. That's you do it because you're living out your faith. We do have to get the message out, and we have to do it. I think the church, the more that churches get on board as institutions, and there's a partnership there, that's I think when some of the magic really can happen. I say this from at least the experience of my mom, who ran a pregnancy care center mm-hmm. clinic for 10 years in Northern Virginia, and there was just one church, and they, whenever there was a need, that church just mobilized and boom, and they were able to quickly expand to medical and do all these sorts of things, and it had to do with the church, not just as individual Christians, but as the institution brought its resources to bear on the center. It really made it a better functioning and a higher performing clinic. or center. And I think that's what has to happen. So, but listen, all that to say, I mean, thanks for your service. I know it's a labor of love and care, and I think, you know, you're an example of one of the also the diversity in the movement, mm-hmm. right? I mean, how many people think this is a woman's issue?
Yeah.
How many men directors? I mean, I've spoken at 25 pregnancy care center fundraising banquets. How many men directors? Mm-hmm. I think you're the first I've met. So, you know, you're kind of like a unicorn, you know.
Do you
really exist? But it's great because arguments don't have genders, right? Babies have genders. But this issue affects men and women and everybody else. So.
Yeah, what last question, as far as, you know, we're about to march, the March for Life is about to occur, possibly in the worst storm Washington's ever seen. But what would be your kind of your last, what is it you want the culture, you want the people that aren't here to know mm-hmm. about what's going on, not just in D.C., but around the country in the pro-life movement?
Well, it's simply this. There's not a better example of Christian engagement of culture than the pro-life movement. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying it hasn't had its hiccups. But if you look at how deeply, passionately these folks care about this issue, hundreds of thousands, millions around America that really care about this issue, and the improvement, the increased kind of strategic nature, the thoughtfulness, the excellence, going medical, I mean, all these different examples mm-hmm. of how this movement has incrementally improved, it's amazing. And, you know, what did we hear in 1973? That the Supreme Court had settled the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court can't change reality. Reality is that, you know, abortion kills an unborn, distinct individual who has eternal value in the eyes of God. And when you live against reality, you get hurt. This is a... And so the reality of what the unborn are is becoming more and more obvious. So look, I would want people to know that this movement is exciting. It is more and more excellent each passing year. It's more and more thoughtful, multifaceted. There's so many different angles on this movement, whether it's, you know, adoption and post-abortive care to reaching out to abortion workers to, you know, strategically trying to defund Planned Parenthood, all these other things. Just amazing! It's an amazing, amazing movement, and I would want people to ride the momentum. There's some momentum that's been building. The videos in 2015 ramped up that momentum. Mm-hmm. Jump on board!
Awesome. Well, thank you, John. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to seeing more of you in the coming future.
Yeah.
You plead my cause. You ride my road.
All right, so Dr. Moore, first off, thank you for having us and having Evangelicals for Life for the entire weekend, it seems like now. We're going to be here for a while. So, but I'm excited about what's going on and that people are prepared to brave the storm for something very important. Mm-hmm. In your book, Onward, you discuss having the opportunity yearly to speak at different churches for Sanctity of Life Sunday. And in there you say you really hate doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. It's not that I hate preaching on the subject of sanctity of,
sure.
of life. I love that. And it's not that I hate that churches are having Sanctity of Life Day. I wish every church would. I hate that we have to have one.
Right.
We have to have one because we live in a fallen world in which things have gone terribly awry. And Sanctity of Human Life Day is a reminder of that to us. I mean, we don't have Reality of Gravity Day because we all just assume mm-hmm. That gravity is real. And my hope and prayer is that eventually Sanctity of Human Life Day will be something that our grandchildren, great-grandchildren will look back and say, why did you have to say that?
Mm-hmm.
That human lives are precious and ought to be protected. Because I hope it will seem obvious to them.
Right. In the same chapter discussing human dignity, you bring up a culture of death. How does this culture reveal itself in our lives and in society?
Well, we see it in the abortion culture, of course. That's the obvious example in which unborn children are seen as an obstacle to advancement or to life. And but we see it also in ways that are more subtle than that. So, for instance, you have threats against the end of life questions with everything from assisted suicide to euthanasia. We see the culture of death in any expression that sees other human beings as a problem to be dealt with rather than as people to be treated as those made in the image of God. And so racial injustice, hostility, hatred between persons and groups is a manifestation of the culture of death as well. And I think we can see it in our own lives in root ways, in the ways, for instance, that often, even within the church, we sometimes see children as a burden. We dread the presence of children. We see them to be managed rather than embracing the blessing of children with all of the complexity that comes along right. with that, including children with special needs and equipping families of children with special needs.
Right. In your writings on dignity, you also said we need to create the kind of kingdom-shaped culture within our churches that constantly shines the light of Christ wherever these false gods exist in our own affections. How do we do that as a church, and how can pastors lead and illustrate this from their pulpit?
Well, the first way is simply to preach the whole counsel of God and to present the vision of the future that the Bible pictures. This is the sort of world that God is moving us toward, in which the first will be last and the last will be first. But also by giving specific examples of challenging people to think in ways that we might be in captivity to mammon in our own lives. And so for pastors and teachers and leaders to stand up and to talk about the joy of caring for that elderly patient with a family member with Alzheimer's who doesn't even recognize the person who is combing her hair, that this is worth it to have that sort of ministry. And in various other ways, to equip the congregation to think about the questions they aren't asking right now. I think that's critically important.
Well, and as an executive director of a pregnancy center myself, I really like to hear from our leaders on what can pregnancy centers do to assist the church in serving and standing for life.
Well, I think one way is to find ways to let the rest of the body of Christ know what is happening in pregnancy resource centers, which are ground zero for so much ministry across the spectrum. And so I think people who aren't familiar with pregnancy resource centers think they're simply places where women are counseled out of having abortions. Of course, that's part of it. But right. as you know better than anyone, it's about far more than that. And so the pregnancy resource centers are places where women are being ministered to in difficult situations, tailored specifically to where their point of crisis is. And so the adoption orphan care movement is the pregnancy resource center movement has been critically key to that. Working with single mothers in job training and in helping to disciple in child rearing, pregnancy resource centers are a critical part of that. In addressing poverty, pregnancy resource centers are a critical part of that. And so I think letting the rest of the church know what's happening so that what's going on in pregnancy resource centers can serve as a model to the rest of the body of Christ, I think, is significant. And also to help people to know that the gifts that they have can be used even if they are not doctors or counselors or ultrasound technicians, but to demonstrate how all the pieces of the body of Christ can work together there.
And my last question, since we are in D.C. and I think it's funny that the weather keeps saying the bullseye of the storm is here.
Right.
And we as pro-lifers are coming to the bullseye where a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
And so for those out there that'll hear this and see what's going on in D.C. today and this weekend, and for those Christians that are saying, well, I don't need to engage in politics. I don't like politics. What would you say from a leader in our movement, from a leader in the Southern Baptist Convention, to say, no, you should be engaged? Why is that? What do you say to that person that says, I don't need to be engaged?
You know, evangelicals tend to want to overreact to the last bad thing. And we have seen some professing Christian leaders who have prostituted themselves out to political mm-hmm. power and who have become hacks. There's no questioning that at all. But the reaction to that is not to withdraw from our responsibilities as citizens. As a matter of fact, that doesn't keep us from becoming hyper-politicized. It's just another way of being hyper-politicized. Because if the church doesn't shape the consciences of people, then the church simply leaves the status quo as the status quo and doesn't speak to issues that are going to be called to an account at judgment. And we have a responsibility to warn and to plead with people. That has to do with issues of personal sin and unrighteousness. Mm-hmm. That also has to do with issues of structural justice and corporate action toward things that are sinful and harmful. And so we have to speak, but we have to do that in a way that maintains a prophetic distance from some sort of cynical political game in order to genuinely equip Christians to be citizens, but to be Christians first.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Dr. Moore.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for doing that.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview with John Stonestreet and Russell Moore. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for supporting Hope. Thank you for standing with us as we boldly stand for life. We'll talk to you soon.
Lift your head, weary sinner. The river's just ahead. Down the path of forgiveness, salvation's waiting there. You've